Welcome to the first episode of the Taylorverse podcast. I'm Sean Taylor, your host, and today I'll be interviewing Keith Giles, who is the best-selling author of the Jesus Un series, as well as the co-publisher of Choir Books. Been looking forward to talking to Keith for a while now, so let's jump right into it, shall we? Thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and Sean, this is great. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm glad you're here. Well, it seems like you're kind of two different writers. There's this prolific writer of religious books like the Jesus Un series and those books. And then there's this co-publisher of Choir, which is speculative sci-fi. How do you get those two to mesh together for you? And do your ideas about faith, are they part of your approach to fiction, or how does that work?
Yeah, well, I actually would say I kind of don't want to mix them. Okay. Really? So when primarily I'm an author, I started off really just being an author and have been a full-time author for like the last 5 years, even before I became the co-owner of Choir Publishing. And so a year ago, Matthew DiStefano and myself became the co-owners of Choir, which was my publisher up to that point. Did a handover, and basically he and I became the new co-owners. And so now that I'm wearing both hats, you know, what we decided to do is we didn't want Choir to necessarily be a quote unquote Christian book publisher, although we still will continue to publish books that talk about faith and religion and things like that. We wanted to just kind of broaden it a little bit and say, well, yes, we publish those kinds of books, but we also publish, for example, science fiction. Or just fiction. We published poetry. We published, art books, children's books, all kinds of stuff. So for us, we want Choir to be known as we're a publisher that publishes great books. And sometimes those books are faith-based. Sometimes those books are not. And so we're not really wanting to blend those things at all. If you buy a fiction book from Choir or a science fiction book from Choir, it may or may not have any sort of themes that point to faith or not. In other words, that's not what we're looking for. We're not looking for like, hey, let's retell, you know, this Bible story in some other format. Like, we just want writers who are good writers, who have good stories to tell, that it's good quality writing. And that's the main thing we're looking for. But then we're not really telling them what they can and can't do either. So they can write whatever book they want to write. And if it's good, we'll publish it.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned, about, you know, you're not necessarily looking for those books, because a lot of times I think of my own history growing up and reading, like, you know, some of George MacDonald's fantasy, C.S. Lewis's sci-fi, particularly space trilogy, and even books from like Ursula Le Guin. So much of her fiction has a spiritual basis to it, not necessarily a Christian basis, but a spiritual basis. And why do you think that's been so popular in sci-fi? What is it about sci-fi and fantasy that opens itself up to dealing with spiritual issues, even though it's not like, you know, necessarily magic or technology driven?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I think science fiction, in general, is a category that allows an author to just explore all kinds of things. And so, you know, some authors want to ask those questions, you know, and like Philip K. Dick is my hero. I love Philip K. Dick. And so he loves to introduce philosophical ideas. He also introduces ideas of faith and religion and things like that. He talks about God a lot. He talks about a lot of Gnostic stuff. Science fiction, though, is just sort of like I think it provides sort of like a sandbox for an author to kind of play with whatever ideas they want to play with. I've always said that I think the great science fiction books are the ones that really, I mean, on the surface, they appear to be about the future. But I think great science fiction books are not just about the future. They're really, honestly, if you dig down deep, they're really about now. They're really saying something to us today. They have a message for us now. It might be warning us about a potential future that we don't want to live in and want us to stop and think about, how do we avoid getting to that kind of a reality? But I think science fiction just allows the author, if that's the author's interest, to kind of introduce philosophical or religious ideas into their story, because then it allows them again to play with it in a way. I always say it allows you to kind of get under the radar. There are things you can do in fiction, things you can say in fiction, things you can have characters say in fiction, that if you just said them straight, you know, without a character, without a setting, without a plot, people's guard is up, and they're kind of like resistant to those ideas. But if they're reading a great story and that's a character they really care about, and there's something happening and they're really concerned about it, and then that character voices a thought or has a feeling or a concern, people internalize that a lot better. And so I think that's one of the things that's really beautiful about science fiction, that it's able to do that. Like I just finished reading Ursula Le Guin, you mentioned. I just read Left Hand of Darkness and then The Dispossessed, which are, they're kind of in a, I think it's called the Hainish series.
Right. Those are actually my two favorites of her books.
Oh yeah. Okay. So yeah, me too. And like The Left Hand of Darkness didn't get really interesting to me until there's a scene about midway through the book. So it was like halfway into the book before she does this, where this character who's sort of an alien character, he's an outsider. He's there as an ambassador kind of, and he meets this group of like a tribe of people who are able to foretell the future. And it is very much based on sort of the mysticism and the faith and the religion of those people. And that entire sequence to me was so fascinating. That was my favorite part. And so Ursula she's more interested in introducing more like Buddhist ideas, I think, like Zen Buddhism and things like that. But still really fascinating ideas. And when you can kind of put them into a context like this is another planet, this is in the future, that creating that distance for the reader, I think it actually allows them a little safer space to consider some of these ideas. And I think that's some of the reasons why.
You mentioned Philip Dick, and I know that you guys have several collections available. I assume that grew out of your love of his work.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Excuse me. Of course. Like, so here's the thing, you know, it took me a couple of months to figure out like, hey, I am the co-owner of a publishing company. I can publish whatever I want. So it was like, I'm a huge Philip K. Dick fan. And we had already been doing something we had started called Choir Classics, which was we discovered there's all kinds of amazing books that are in the public domain. And we thought how great it would be to get kind of give them a new cover, get someone who's probably a more well-known established author today to write a foreword to that book, and we can sort of reintroduce these Choir Classics to people. So we've been doing that already. We did Alice in Wonderland with David Bentley Hart writing a foreword. We did Tolstoy's The Kingdom of God is Within You. I wrote the foreword to that one. We've done The Call of the Wild. We've done Brothers Karamazov, all of that. And anyway, I was like, hey, you know, I discovered there were several Philip K. Dick short stories in the public domain, like I think like 15 or something.
Right.
So yeah, we published the volume one last year, and I wrote the foreword to that one. But the volume two of collection of Philip K. Dick short stories will be out next month. And his widow, Tessa Dick, wrote that foreword.
Oh,
and
nice.
Volume three is in the pipeline. It probably will release early next year. And David Agronoff, who's also one of our choir authors, wrote the foreword to that one. He's also the host of the Philip K. Dick. It's called the Dickheads podcast. He wrote the foreword to that one. So it's been fun. It's fun to like kind of reintroduce Philip K. Dick. And I got to speak last year at the San Diego Comic-Con, on a panel, with other people talking about Philip K. Dick. And that was such an honor. It was such like a dream come true, to be able to talk about Philip K. Dick and his writing and the impact of all that. So it's been a blast. In fact, I'm going to be speaking, in June at the Philip K. Dick Fest in Fort Morgan, Colorado, as well. So that's kind of fun. Like being, I guess, because, I'm not just a fan now that I'm a publisher, I'm getting invited to come and speak at some of these events that are focused on Philip K. Dick and his writing. And that's a lot of fun.
Oh, that's very, very cool. Yes. Well, let's change gears just a minute there. Let's look at your Jesus Un books. I mentioned they're kind of the thing that a lot of people know you for. And in those, you tend to cut through a lot of the sort of for lack of a better metaphor, barnacles that have attached themselves to sort of the ship of faith. And try to just get back to the idea of Jesus. Why is that so important to you?
Yeah, well, it's definitely important to me. It's so when I wrote the first book, which was Jesus Untangled, the subtitle is Crucifying Our Politics to Pledge Allegiance to the Lamb. I mean, all of the books in the series really came out of my own personal growth and studies and things like that. And that was the first one I wrote. I never intended to write a series. It just kind of happened. But when I wrote the first one, I had myself realized that I was more American than Christian. And really, that I was more sort of Republican conservative than I was truly Christian. What I mean is that, you know, to be a Christian is to be, you know, Christ-like. That's what Christian means, like little Christ or Christ-like. And that much of my beliefs were more informed by my politics than by my anything Jesus said. And I was like, no, if I'm going to be a Jesus follower, I need to focus on what Jesus was all about. And the more I did that, the more I realized that many of the things that I thought were true or very important were things that Jesus either didn't care about or maybe even said some of the opposite things. So I went through my own little process of sort of disentangling my faith from my politics. And in the process of doing that, did a lot of research, discovered that it's not an accident that American Christians today are so entangled with sort of conservative politics, because that was something in the 1950s that people strategically made a decision to do. They had a plan and they did it. And if I fast forward to today, I would say it worked. And it's still, unfortunately, it's still working. So anyway, I wrote that book, again, just because it was something that I thought was really important. Again, when I wrote it, my concern at the time, this was in 20, it was written in 2016. I published it in 2017 on Inauguration Day. And my concern at that time was to just sort of warn Christians to say, hey, if we're not careful, this Christian nationalism could become a problem. It could be a bad thing. We might not want to go down that road, that theocracies are historically very violent, bloody affairs, and we probably shouldn't do that. Well, you know, again, fast forward to today, and that's exactly where we're going, you know, and so it's still relevant. But then, yeah, I continued in my studies and my own personal sort of deconstruction process. The second book was Jesus Unbound. I wrote that book is about the Bible and how to approach the Bible. Honestly, I usually recommend people, if they want to read the series, I usually recommend they start with that one.
Oh.
Even though it's the second one that I wrote chronologically, I think it's the most foundational one. So, because I think if you don't understand how to approach the Bible, the rest of my books probably aren't going to make sense to you. Are you going to struggle with it? So I think Jesus Unbound is the book that I think the subtitle of that one is Liberating the Word of God from the Bible, because the Word of God is Christ. It's not the book that we wrote about Christ. Because again, I also felt this in myself, and then the more I researched it and studied it, the more I realized, like, I had a lot of friends, a lot of Christians who sort of equated the Bible. Oh, it's almost like Father, Son, and Holy Bible. Like the Bible had become this thing of worship. Instead of like the person that the Bible points to. My big point in that book was that the Bible is like a menu that's suggesting a wonderful meal that you should partake in. You don't eat the menu. You know, it's the menu isn't the meal. Or the Bible is like a map pointing you to a treasure. But if you start treasuring the map, then you don't get the treasure because you settled for the map. So that was something really important. And I won't go through all of them. There's seven of them. But each of those books in the series deals with a different topic that I felt like, as you said, I felt like that there was an historic Jesus. And I study a lot of early church history. So this is where a lot of this comes from. And recognizing that the way the Christian faith looked and behaved and believed in the first, let's say, 300 years of church history is almost unrecognizable to us today. Like, we are so far away from what that Christianity looked like. And so I wanted to point that out, but I also wanted to explain it and understand it and help my readers understand, how do we get from this way back, you know, sort of pre-Constantine, to where we are today. And each of the books in the Jesus Sons series, the goal is to sort of shine a light on those things, and hopefully bring us back to, I always say, people call me a progressive Christian. I always say, no, I'm a regressive Christian. I think we should go back to sort of first century, second century Christianity that was more Jesus focused and Jesus based, and not what it's become today.
Yeah, I love that. I think one of the things that really appealed to me about your writing and about your books, because I also get confused, accused of being progressive. But is that you surround yourself with people from a lot of different faiths and different viewpoints.
Yeah.
And I assume that's going to be important to you, not just as a faith writer, but just as a writer in general, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I've always, I shouldn't say always, but certainly in the last 10 years or so, I have recognized that I have a lot to learn, and that you don't learn things by surrounding yourself with people who, no matter what you say, they just nod their head and smile. You know, like if all they do is validate everything you currently believe, that's not a recipe for growth or maturity. And so I've tried to surround myself with people that don't agree with me about everything. And I want to listen to them, genuinely learn and listen from them. Because again, unless I hear an idea that challenges my assumptions or, you know, pushes or stretches something that I currently believe and sort of my own personal status quo, I'm never going to grow. I'm never going to learn. So I've been trying to do that in various ways. I host a bunch of podcasts. So I'm always talking to different people from different perspectives. My wife, Wendy, and I did a house church for like 11 years. And the way that house church group was structured, we had no statement of faith. And the only sort of statement of faith was, or as an invitation, really, it was sort of like, if you love Jesus and your idea of a great time is spending 2 or 3 hours in the same room with a bunch of other people that love Jesus, you're welcome. There's a table, you know, there's a chair available. There's a room on the couch for you. And people were invited into something knowing that we didn't agree on every point of doctrine and theology, but that our goal was not to argue and debate and fix and correct each other. Our goal was to listen to each other and learn to love one another, because what we had in common was Jesus, but we didn't feel like we weren't there to sort of have this level of agreement. What we discovered was that it's possible to have unity without agreement. We actually can have unity based on love and connection and mutual respect for one another. We don't have to all agree with the same sort of statement of faith or doctrines. And I know, especially today, for a lot of Christians, that just sounds like impossible, but I did it for 11 years, and I know it's not only possible, it's glorious. It was beautiful. It was a wonderful thing.
I was going to say, that does not sound like the American church much today at all, where the whole bottom line is we all have to believe the same thing and have the same doctrine and the same theology, or else you go to that other church, you know? So
right. Well, see, but here's the thing that we learned in that. You're right about that, right? So I know that's the way that a lot of churches attempt to, I would say, sort of artificially create the illusion of unity. Because you're right. So like, you know, I was formerly a Southern Baptist, and then I spent some time in the Vineyard Church movement and was on staff at different non-denominational churches and stuff over the years as a pastor. And we always had a statement of faith. And people had to sit through some kind of new believers class or new members class. And we had to go down all the things we believe and everything. And at the end, they had to sign a document saying they agree with all that stuff. But I know for a fact, I knew people and I did it myself, where it was like, look, my kids just love the youth group here. Or you guys have a great children's group or children's ministry. I want to bring my kids here. Or I really like the worship. Or I really like the pastor. So you know what? I'm going to just pretend I agree with all this stuff. I really don't. But I'll sign it. I won't make waves. I won't make a big stink about it. But yeah, I don't really believe all of those points. And so it's a unity. It's an illusion of unity based on agreement. But the truth is a lot of people sitting in the pews, they don't agree with everything. They just know that if they were to say something out loud that they disagree with this or that, they'd be kicked out. And they're right. Mm-hmm. So they keep their mouth shut. Whereas, you know, we thought it was better in our context to be like, What if we just let you believe? Like, you can have those beliefs. We're not going to try to change your mind, and it's okay, right? And again, I learned a lot from people that normally I would never even have been in the same room with, simply because we were all willing to give each other that freedom to have our different beliefs. And this is the thing as well. Like, I'll say for myself, my beliefs are a moving target. Like, over the last 10, 15 years, I've changed my mind on a lot of things, right? And I quote this all the time. A friend of mine gave me this quote. He said, you know, the funny thing about all my views is that no matter how many times they change, I'm always right. And that's the way we sort of kind of go through, a lot of Christians, that's how we go through our sort of faith journey, is that I believe this, I'm right. I changed my mind. Oh, now I'm right. 2 years later, I changed my mind again. Now I'm right again. And that idea that I'm always right is wrong. The truth is, I was wrong before. I'm probably wrong about some things now, and I promise you I'm going to be wrong in the future about something. So it's not about being right about everything. I think we have to let go of that and just hold loosely. I always say, like, don't let the cement dry on those things. You know, hold loosely to those things. Embrace this sort of mystery of God, and give yourself permission to, like, hey, I'm open. I'm still thinking. I'm still learning. I'm still growing. I'm not. And then that's the reason why I'm not intimidated by being in fellowship or connection with people who think differently than me, because I don't see it as a threat to something, because it's already kind of held loosely, right? I don't feel like I need to protect it. And I'm not, and I haven't put all of my identity in that belief system. Whereas if it got shaken, it would rock me to my core. It's not like that for me. I'm excited to learn something and grow, and those kind of things are positive for me.
It reminds me a lot of a quote from a guy named John Fisher, who I used to read in the back of CCM
Magazine.
Oh,
I love John Fisher.
Oh, I do too. He's fantastic. But he wrote this thing. He said, Jesus is the answer, but we've forgotten what the questions are.
That's right.
And I just love that. But yeah, what you're saying reminds me a lot of that. The idea that, well, we kind of skip to, we have to know the answer in order to say that we've arrived, I guess, you know.
Yeah. It's so funny that you said that.
Faith has to have arrived. It can't be in process, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, it's so funny you said John Fisher, because, like, he was my hero, man. I can remember I used to read. I was a huge, huge fan of, like, Christian alternative music and stuff when I was in college. Right. And I subscribed to all those magazines, but CCM was one of them. After a while, I stopped really wanting to read the magazine, because I realized the reviews were kind of, you know, propaganda. But
right.
But the back column was John Fisher. And
right.
I kept that subscription for at least 2 or 3 years, simply because every month I wanted to read his column in the back. And when I started blogging, he was my sort of template. Like, I want to write the way John Fisher writes. And I got to meet him a few years later when I moved to California.
Oh,
and
cool.
He and I become good friends. And we used to live in Orange County at the same time. And got to hang out a little bit. So I love John Fisher. He's one of my heroes. He's great.
Oh, he's definitely one of my heroes of faith. He, just because he's always, you know, like you say, he's always questioning things.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. Jumping gears just a little bit again to something to appeal to our the various writers who read this blog. Let's talk about promotion. You've got a really unique way, I've noticed, of doing promoting your new book releases. I've taken part in one for Soledad Deus. And care to just share a little bit about that approach and why it works for you?
Oh, yeah, I will. And it's, yes, if you're an author, I'm going to give you very, very important advice about promoting your books. Again, as I said, I have been a full-time author, meaning I make my living primarily through my writing and my books. And I've been doing that even before I was co-owner of Carr Publishing. So just as an author, before any of that happened a year ago, I had been doing that for like 4 years. And one of the primary things that I've learned over the, and again, I published, like, my 11th book is coming out next month. Or sorry, this is April, coming out this month. So, you know, I've written a lot of books and published a lot of books and had a lot of bestsellers and all that. And so here's what we have learned. I will say, I knew this personally for myself that it worked. A year ago, when Matt and I took over Choir, we started implementing this with our authors with Choir. And so we, for a year now, I have been training our Choir authors to do this exact same thing about the, what I'm about to tell you, what it is, the secret. And what I've noticed is that is the determining factor of success. If they do everything but this, or they do everything and they fail in this one thing, their book is a flop. But if they nail this one thing, and we do everything else, like as a publisher on the other side of a promotion, the book is huge. It launches. And really that's the key. It's called the book launch team. And I didn't invent this in any way. I don't even know where I heard about it, but since I've started doing it, it works. And so the launch team as an author, what you do is, before the book comes out. So usually about a month before the book comes out, I kind of put the word out on social media, mainly on Facebook is where I will create like a private Facebook group for people. And you want to get anywhere from, I mean, I would ideally probably 30 to 50, as many as you can get, but I mean, you're probably going to get like 30 to 50 people, to agree to join your book launch team. And so it works like this, this real simple formula. What you say is, this is how you invite people to the book launch team. You go, hey, I have my new book is coming out. Here's the title. It's coming out next month. If you want to help me launch the team, I need you to do these four things. Number one, read an advanced PDF copy of the book, which I will send to you. So that on launch day, you will do these things in this order. On launch day, you will buy the book on Amazon, either the Kindle or the print version. Then you will leave a rating and review because Amazon will track verified purchases. So you have to buy it first. And then you leave your rating and review. And then the fourth step is share a link on your social media to all your followers and say, hey, Keith has a new book. It just came out. It's so awesome. Check it out. Here's the link. And if you do those four things, there's like sort of a bonus gift thing where I'll put together something exclusively for all the people in the group that were able to accomplish that for me. And that is the secret. That is honestly the big deal. And the reason why is you really need it. The word launch is apropos. If you think about all the work and planning and energy that it takes to get a rocket to break gravity and get up into orbit, right? That's a tremendous amount of effort and energy that has to happen to get that, you know, rocket up into orbit. But once it's up in orbit, it takes very little energy to keep it in orbit, right? Just little taps, little touches here and there, because it's already reached a certain level. And what I mean is by that is that if on the day and the week, certainly the week is the most critical time period, if the day and the week of your launch of your book on Amazon, you have 40 or 50 sales on that day or during that week. And then you're getting 5-star reviews, 4-star reviews, and people are sharing those links. Amazon's algorithm will kick in and then they will now start promoting your book for you because they realize, hey, this is a hot new seller. And those ratings and reviews are also very important as well. It's not just, hey, you're getting a bunch of sales all in the 24-hour period. It's also those ratings and reviews. They really mean a lot. So you could have, this is true, you could have thousands of sales of your book, but if you don't have a single rating or review, Amazon is not going to promote that book. Right. So you need both. You need the sales, but you certainly need those ratings and reviews. And then, of course, the more you get, the better. Like you should, I would say as an author, you want to try to get your book first to, let's say, get it to 50 reviews. But then once you do that, then you want to get to 100, really 100 reviews is the magic number. And anything over 100, yeah, you're doing really good. So, but yeah, that's the secret. That's what really works. That's what we have been trying to train our choir authors to do. I have a training that I still do. I sell it, called Authors Academy, to kind of like train authors. Hey, here's how I became a full-time author. Here, you know, I'll just teach you to do what I know how to do. But we make it available for free to our choir authors. So if we like your book idea and we sign you to publish your book, you'll get access to that for free.
Okay. Well, you stay really busy. Like you say, you do this full time. And I mean, with your writing alone, with all these books, right, coming out, but you also manage to make time for several podcasts. I particularly love Heretic Happy Hour, and Second Cup with Keith is the other one. I'll probably check out Heretic Happy Hour more so than Second Cup. just because I love the varying opinions in it and everything.
Sure.
But do you find that doing those extra things on top of your writing, they support or inspire you, or do they distract you from your blank screen of writing?
That's an interesting question. Well, I would say overall, no, it helps a lot on many levels. So yeah, I do like, currently I do 4 podcasts. One of them is weekly, like every Wednesday, I do the God Squad with John Fuglesang. And then I do Heretic Happy Hour. Heretic Happy Hour is about to go weekly as well. We're going to relaunching it. Just today we're posting all the news about that. So that's happening right now. That'll be a weekly podcast as well. And like you said, Second Cup and Apostates Anonymous are the other two that I do. No, what I found is, it's really helpful because otherwise I think I'd be in a vacuum. You know, I need, especially on those podcasts you mentioned where I have co-hosts or we have guests, we're interviewing people, quite often something will be sparked in those conversations that I'll be like, oh man, that is great. Yes, I got to talk about that, or I need to research into that or something. So it really helps me when I'm writing, certainly when I'm writing my sort of nonfiction theology books. And I also do a course called Square One, which is helping people deconstruct. And I would say my book, Sola Mysterium and Sola Deus, came directly from conversations I had with people in that course, in that community. So yeah, having those conversations with people in community, whether it's a podcast or a course or something like that, definitely helps me and inspires me and keeps the ideas flowing. And yeah, as you said, certainly keeps me busy. But see, that's what you want to do anyway as an author. Like I always recommend to authors as well, if you're an author, you should have at least one podcast probably of your own. And then, but I also recommend that you find a way to get yourself as a guest like this on other podcasts.
Absolutely. Yeah.
As well. So that, cause all that just helps, you know, and you need to get your name out there and get your voice out there as much as you can.
All right. Last question, cause we're about to butt up against time here. And it is this, tell me a little bit about your most recent work, where people can get it and where they can get more information and learn more about you and Choir and the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Sean. Yeah. So my most recent book, it'll be out next. Oh, sorry. I keep saying next month. It's April this month. April the 23rd. My new book is called The Quantum Sayings of Jesus. The subtitle is Decoding the Lost Gospel of Thomas. I spent the last year and a half writing a weekly blog series on my Pathos blog and on my Patreon called Inner Circle, where every Friday I would post sort of a commentary on one of the sayings of Jesus from the Gospel of Thomas. And this book, when I first read Thomas, I hated it. I thought it was ridiculous and dumb and pointless. But my friend William Duffy wrote a book that totally changed my mind, kind of helped me decode Thomas. And then I got excited. Then the more I read Thomas, the more I thought, oh my gosh, yeah, this is something really great. So I'm very excited about that book. It's 114 sayings from Thomas is a commentary on each of the sayings, as well as a lot of material about why Thomas was lost, how it was found, why it's important, why scholars believe it is legitimately a collection of the sayings of Jesus. And that's all it is. It's not really a gospel. It's just a collection of the sayings of Jesus. Half of them are in the New Testament gospels. Half of them are brand new. And so yeah, really excited for that book to come out. And yeah, you can find me online. I mean, I have a blog, KeithGiles.com is my blog on Pathos, and you can follow me there. You can also find me on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and all of the above. All my books are on Amazon as well. You can check them out. And, I'm happy to connect with people. If you're an author and you want to connect, just ask for advice about being an author, or you want to maybe have something you want to pitch to Choir, you can go to choir.com. It's Q-U-O-I-R.com and, check that out.
Cool. I appreciate it. And I will also be posting along with this video links to all of those various places. So I'll just check in with you, make sure we get those. But thank you so much, Keith. This has been wonderful just sitting and chatting with you. And maybe we can get together and just, you know, talk about John Fisher sometime.
That would be great. I would love that. Thank you so much, Sean.
Awesome. Thank you so much. All righty. Bye.
Bye-bye.